Climate change is a planetary, planet-sized problem, right? But we experience the effects locally. And increasingly, those effects are more extreme weather events all across our country that are experienced as local events for the people in that community. But the cost is also mounting. So more extreme and more often. And then thank you to our partners at Climate Central. Here's what that looks like in data. And I should say, we have a QR code for it. So all the data and links you see will be available to you as well. So you can take all the notes from it. We'll have it with a one camera QR code as well. So, you know, the data tells part of the story, but ultimately, this is human impact, right? So we have climate hitting home. And I'm going to say that I think all of us are here because we believe in the informative power of journalism. But what happens if the information isn't landing? And if change isn't happening? So this is, first of all, a bit of an eye chart, so I'll leave it up for a minute. I ask you to search for your role on this slide. This is a compelling piece of research from the folks who do the Yale Climate Opinion Maps, came out in the fall, on the politics of climate change and trusted messengers. And to simplify what you're seeing, it depicts the political spectrum in four categories, from extreme left to extreme right. And then it ranks who are the most to least trusted messengers by party affiliation. And I'll save you a little bit of the work and jump to the punchline. There are only two roles, sources of information, who are trusted messengers across the full political spectrum: NASA and TV meteorologists. So, if you can get an astronaut to talk to you, great. Otherwise, you're in the right place today. Because we're here to talk about the role that TV meteorologists are playing and can play, and how you might partner with them in your community to make sure that the information you're reporting is landing. We may not have an information problem. It may be we have a communication problem. I think folks you're going to meet today are doing some great work on how to connect the dots. And at the risk of saying something from inside the newsroom, never let a good crisis go to waste. So when extreme weather happens, we have larger audiences. We have their attention for that moment in time. And it's an opportunity to connect the dots between extreme weather and its roots in climate change. So that is the premise of today's conversation. If you haven't seen, there are a few great articles that have been written connecting the dots and why TV meteorologists are effective messengers. This was a great piece in The Atlantic. Another great piece by the folks at Grist profiling John Morales in Miami, probably the first Latino-speaking meteorologist to connect those dots. More on that in a moment. There is some great work being done around the country, and it may be outside of your current journalism loop. So it's part of what we hope to do today, is show you some of what's being done. I mean, these are two great examples. Jeff's been at this a long time in Miami, Mike Nelson in Denver, directly connecting the dots. And part of what we're gonna talk about with the panel today is how bold can you be? How bold should you be in connecting those dots? And how can you do that grounded in science, rather than worrying about straying into opinion or evidence. So, with that set up, I'll give you the first shot, but not your only shot. The QR codes, all the links. We have some great video examples today because these are folks who work in visual storytelling. I love seeing. Well, I feel like I should take a selfie while I'm taking But right now, my pleasure to welcome the panelists to get to the real meat of the show. Nelly Cadena, chief meteorologist at Univision in Dallas, and I have questions about Texas and climate change information receptiveness. Lauren Casey is a meteorologist and part of Climate Central. I should say, has been a great partner to the LMA. Covering Climate Collaborative works with newsrooms to get the science right and to provide localized data sets on climate. And Chase Kane, who kind of co-authored the idea for this panel, meteorologist, I can say meteorologist, can I?
Soon, yes.
Yes, soon.
Look at the joys of final days of grad school, right? So thanks for being here, because we know what those stresses are like. With NBC LX, which, if you're not familiar, streaming service specifically targeting younger consumers who still want their information in video, but maybe aren't watching your parents' fiber. So great to have you all here. Nellie, I'd love to start with you. And I am going to make an assumption that in this audience, lots of folks may not realize what life is like day-to-day being a local meteorologist. Like, when you go to the grocery store, how much extra, you don't have to answer this, but like how much extra time you have to budget for all the conversations you want. I mean, local TV meteorologists are highly recognized. Talk about, you know, the kind of relationship of trust you feel you have with the audience, and then I'd love to have you tell what you did in preparation for this panel with your audience.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Well, it's different. Being a TV meteorologist is different if you work in Spanish or English and in different parts of the nation. I'll give you an example. I was mentioning that I worked for NBC in Boston, and they were very open to talk about climate change. I was encouraged to do it. But then when I came to Texas, shocking, they don't really want you to talk about it because you can get really bad feedback. Not necessarily the division, but just that market, the TV market in Dallas, Fort Worth, is not very climate friendly. And so I decided, preparing for this presentation, to talk to my viewers, because I feel like Spanish-speaking viewers care about different things than English-speaking viewers. And I worked in English and Spanish in Chicago, all English in Boston, and now all Spanish in Dallas. And what I've come to learn from Spanish speaker in Dallas, they're not your regular viewers, because a lot of my viewers work in construction. And if it's 110 degrees, 108, they pass out. They can't work. So they care a lot about that. And so I did some research of my own, and I did a questionnaire of 500 of our viewers, and they answered this questionnaire of 500, which was amazing, and I did it in a week.
Yeah, so if you just linger on that, so like, how did you ask them? And you started a week ago, and you were texting me, and like, I've got 300, I've got 500. And so part of it, I want to underscore that is an amazing relationship.
Yes.
That your audience is willing to give you that kind of
right,
feedback.
And it took years to build that, and it took us through. I'm sure you guys remember in Dallas about 3 years ago, we had an ice storm mixed in with COVID, mixed in with power failure, and that almost 300 people died in Texas. It was catastrophic. And we just had a tornado go right through Dallas in 2020, North Dallas. You know, it went through three highways on a Sunday. Just not too long ago, I had 17 tornadoes in one day in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So these things that are happening really bond you as a meteorologist with your viewers, because you're living, I mean, my power went out, my house flooded, right? Because I was in a hotel next to the station because nobody else had power. And so you build this trust. And so when I asked, the way that I asked, I simply said, I'm honored to be going to a climate conference in Boise, Idaho, and I need your help. I need to know how you feel about climate change. If you want me to include climate change more in my presentations, because I do include some, but not enough, just because of the environment that I felt that I was in. But boy, was I wrong. Not to
Run through some of the
We can go through kind of quick. I can't see them, but all of them were in the 90s. I think the first one was...
So first is real?
Right. I started real basic. Do you... Because it's Texas, you know? Do you think that climate change is real or fake? And I wanted to know. And obviously, the majority said real. And there were a lot of... some of the comments that didn't pick real picked super real. And yes... So only one or two said chemtrails, and the other one said no.
I do want to, like, for our non-Spanish reading buddies, want to point out that, yes, no matter the language, you will get a chemtrail viewer. Yes. Any survey.
At least one of the viewers was very into it, and so every question he replied something about chemtrails. He really wants me to investigate that.
This one spoke to your, you know, example of your audience and how this affects
right.
The
so, and this question was geared towards, because, once again, not to generalize, but I know my audience, and a lot of them work in construction, a lot of them work outdoors. And so I wanted to know if these conditions, you know, extreme heat, extreme cold, directly impact their pocket, right? Like, whether they're going to work that day. It's not just inconvenience. It's, am I going to make any money today? And 90-something. I have my glasses.
Yeah.
A lot. 83. 83?
Yep.
Okay, 83. So a high number.
And then humans directly.
90% said that humans are directly contributing, but the one that really shocked me was this one, right?
It's getting worse.
Oh, is it the...
Yeah, so
do you feel like it's getting worse? Which it is, right? We've had very... I've never... You know, I grew up in Dallas, Fort Worth, and I remember some ice storms, but nothing like what we've had the last couple of years. It's never been like that. And so they realize it, too, that it's just getting more extreme. And then finally...
Well, and can it on this one, can, you know, the thing that jumps out about this is at a national conversation level, this issue, like so many others, have been turned into a political football. This question speaks to, you know, in your community, your lived experience, people are, you know, your audience is telling you, I mean, 95% notice the change. That's really powerful.
It's really powerful, and I don't think that it's just in my market. I think Latinos, Hispanics come from countries where the earth is very important, where food is organic, where it's more spiritual in some of these countries. And so I knew the numbers would be high, that they care, because they care about things like this, but I never expected it to be that high. And one of the questions said, do you want me to include more? And that one was the highest, 97% or 98%?
97%.
97%, and some of the others even said, you know, agreed with it, but even more, right? So this is definitely going to, you know, I'm going to go to my producers armed with this information, and it's going to help me to really include it. I feel kind of dumb that I didn't know the approval rate for how hungry people are for information, and they want to know why we're having these tornadoes, why we're having these, you know, 105 degree days over and over and over again. And so this research really helped me to prepare, and I learned even before coming here a lot. But
and you also said, you know, these are some of the, you can tell, you know, maybe what you think a few of the highlights are.
Yeah.
The specific kinds of things that you're, which again, I think this is such a valuable conversation to have with the audience versus just we, the journalists, decide what you need to know. So how about asking the audience what you
right.
Need to
know? Right, so I try to make it really easy because, you know, because it's a climate questionnaire, so I didn't think many people were gonna want to take it or take the time to take it. And so, but I did do 8 questions, and then do you wanna write in anything, right? Not necessary, but if you want to. And so some of these, I wanna know more about the state of the ocean. I want to know how climate change is impacting my daily life. Is the government doing it to help with air contamination from factories? What is the impact that these huge climate changes are causing on my everyday life? Which one?
Well, I
was saying
tornadoes.
Oh, yeah. Tornadoes came up a lot. They want a lot of information about tornadoes because tornadoes impact us quite a bit. In April and May. So they wrote in a lot of things. Obviously, I'm going to take some of this information and kind of expand, but to me, it's been very eye-opening, and I feel like I have a better grasp on how hungry people are for information with climate.
Oh, I love that you did that. It's an exercise we could repeat in every market. Yale, I referenced them earlier, they're linked QR code. Yale has county by county for the whole country. You can do surveys and see exactly where people in your community stand on behavioral attitude and policy issues. I predict in every single place that you think is red, you'll be surprised to see how much actual support there is for a lot of these policies, a lot of the reporting. And so, I mean, I think this is a conversation that happens over and over, where we hear from the loud minority. We do not hear from the silent majority unless we reach out and engage in a conversation. So these are powerful takeaways. It leads to the question of, well, then, when people in a community start to notice these dramatic, consistent changes in their everyday experience with weather, how can you connect the dots for them? And how can you connect the dots accurately, grounded in science? And so, Laura, it's great to have you. And, you know, I think this making the distinction between weather and climate, and all, I'm trying to help you out, you know, not all weather is climate, and we want to get that right. And Climate Central has, you know, I know firsthand, really made, you know, brought out a tool that's very powerful. Journalists have just looked at and talked about the attribution index and sort of what we think we know about what can and cannot be said in making that connection.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here. Thank you all for joining us. So attribution science is a rapidly emerging field in climate science. It has come leaps and bounds in really just the last decade. So taking an extreme weather event and attributing climate to it. Now, we can't say that, you know, climate change caused a weather event. Weather happens, right? But we can associate or correlate climate change and the frequency or the likelihood and also the magnitude or the intensity of that event can be attributed to climate change. And there are a lot of tools out there if you know where to find them. And there are many, many thousands of studies at this point on attribution science and specific extreme weather events. So, and we also have our own tool at Climate Central, the Climate Shift Index. Now, this takes a look at climate's impact on our daily temperatures. So minimum temperatures, high temperatures, and then average temperatures. So taking those two and averaging them. So it gives you a look at what and how climate change is having an impact on people's everyday lives. It's not even just extreme weather. It's our daily weather. We can see the difference. How much more likely are these temperatures? And it really comes into play when we're dealing with extreme heat. How much has climate change contributed to this heat on this day, this extreme heat, or this heat wave? Because if we didn't have climate change, if we didn't have greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, how would the atmosphere have behaved, and comparing those two? So we really want to move the conversation forward from, you know, it took a while to get everyone on board with climate change, and as we've seen, saying climate change is real. That conversation is over. And thanks in large part to journalists going out there and disseminating this information, disseminating the science, you know, putting it in front of people's faces and saying this is real and it's having an impact on our everyday lives. And it's impacting our weather all across the globe. So yes, of course, there is that quite loud minority, but they're a minority. And, you know, they're going to be left behind. It's about 10% what we would consider dismissive. And that's it. The rest are on board. So we want to move the conversation forward away from climate change is real. We know that. Let's move the conversation more towards attribution and how it's impacting people's everyday lives. So Climate Shift Index, do you want to play the video?
We have visual storytellers, so we are sprinkling a few videos in here. And I will attempt, this is almost the lottery moment in a presentation, where we press the button and see what happens.
The weather, be it an extreme heat event of last week's or just a single hot day, we often get asked, what's climate change got to do with it? Did the weather get a boost from the extra carbon pollution in the atmosphere? Or was the change just the weather? Using the latest scientific research, we can now answer those questions with our new resource called the Climate Shift Index, or CSI. I'm Andrew Persian, Director of Climate Science at Climate Central. Climate Shift Index is a free tool that you can use to understand just how much global warming influenced a certain day's weather. The strength of this connection is given by a number and a color. So how are we able to put a number on the connections? We We began by looking at the frequency of temperatures at a location in our current climate with about 1.3 degrees Celsius, or nearly 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit of global warming. We then used the latest models, data, and peer-reviewed methods to remove the global warming signal. The climate shift index compares how often a given temperature will occur in our current climate with the frequency of that temperature in a climate without global warming. Positive CSI values mean that climate change has made the temperatures you're experiencing more likely. Negative CSI values mean that climate change has made these connections less likely. In mid-December of 2021, the Midwest experienced several days of unusually warm conditions. At its peak, the event reached level 5, a very high number on the CSI. This means that human-caused climate change made these conditions more than 5 times as likely. Or in other words, that heat would be nearly impossible in a world without carbon pollution. A few days earlier, the Midwest experienced an unusual tornado outbreak. The level 1 and 2 CSI values show that the heat that fueled the storms had a detectable climate fingerprint. Climate change can reveal itself in dramatic ways, like with extreme heat waves and raging wildfires and crippling droughts or massive downpours. But global warming is also changing the world we live in each and every day, often more subtle, but still significant ways. The CSI will help us understand and see those everyday connections. You can get 3-day CSI maps on Climate Central's website. There you'll also be able to dig deeper into the Climate Shift Index, learn more about how we calculate the CSI, and what these connections mean for you.
The journalist in me feels compelled to ask this, but can you say a little more? So who is Climate Central and why should we trust their index? Just for context.
Just trust me, okay?
I've seen how that works.
We're a nonprofit organization, we're not advocacy, and we specialize in climate change research and communication, and we our whole goal is to work with broadcast meteorologists and journalists and providing them research, data, graphics, localized graphics, so they can go and take those and integrate them into the stories that they're telling in their markets, in their neighborhoods, in their states, to better help their viewers, their users, their readers understand these connections. As Andy was talking about, my colleague in the video, you know, taking the extreme heat that was influenced or the above average heat that was influenced by climate change, making the connection there, and then connecting the dots back to fueling the atmosphere for a tornadic event. So there are many connections to be made in this realm. Was that inadequate? You should trust us?
I will in the Q&A. We will find out. But I should add, the LMA Climate Collaborative's work with Climate Central in my prior role in broadcasting, and I think you have over 800 meteorologists that you now work with.
Actually, Frank, we now have over 1,000.
That's why we asked the question.
We have over 3,000 journalists we work with as well. We've done, I've been on board for about a year now. I was a broadcast meteorologist for about 16 years before moving to Climate Central. So I'm also aware of the challenges that are faced by TV meteorologists. So I can provide that lens to the work we create to help better serve our network of meteorologists and journalists. We have journalists at Climate Central as well. John Upton is with us, and he's wandering around here somewhere. If you want to pull him aside.
Before we go to Chase, I did want to ask you, because you have yourself kind of now lived in both of those roles, what do you see as effective? What to you are the best practices for meteorologists? You know, I like to think it is like kind of the chief science officer in local TV newsrooms. I mean, it's generally the person in the newsroom that has the most advanced science degree.
Oh, absolutely.
They also have the biggest audience recognition.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing that is most effective for folks in that role to make this connection?
Most effective as far as disseminating the information?
Well, in making the connection where it is appropriate to climate change is the root for it.
That's a good question. And you don't want to shove science down people's throats, right? Or make things too complex. You need to bring it down to people's level where they can understand it. We've been recently doing some testing of the climate shift index with our global tool with a handful of broadcast meteorologists around the country. And the feedback that they have gotten has been positive. We've gotten viewer emails saying, thank you for showing this. And they're showing it, you know, we thought we might have to like give them like a push a little bit, like, hey, don't forget to use it. They're using it multiple times a week in multiple different shows to tell different weather stories in their own communities. And, oh yeah, there they are.
Yeah. These are great because they're literally localizable data sets that you don't need to be a hint. You don't need to be a local TV meteorologist to access these data sets and enhance your storytelling visually.
Right. Yes, absolutely, and journalists can use them as well. And yeah, climate shift index can be a complex concept, right? As Andy was explaining, I'm glad he did a big explanation of the science behind it. But you know, people do understand when they're looking at the colors there. They're understanding the scale. They're understanding that it's becoming more likely because of climate change and because this information is being disseminated by trusted messengers, as Frank talked about in the beginning, NASA scientists and TV meteorologists or journalists. That they take that information to heart, and it allows them to make the connections of the extreme weather they're seeing all around them and going, oh, that's because of climate change.
And I know, you know, for QR code fans, there's a direct pathway just to the resources for Climate Matters for anyone interested. I also have a link in the master doc, but I'll leave that up for
definitely grab that code and sign up.
Chase, I know this is a passion topic for you. Why do you feel it's so important to make these weather connections? And, you know, why do you think, if you do, why do you think people have hesitated in journalism and on air in meteorology? I know we have an example to share, but just first look, just at a high level, you know, kind of, why do you think it's so critical to make that connection more forceful?
I think when we, first of all, hi everyone, happy to be here with you. I think there's a funny thing that we as people do sometimes when we don't know what to talk about someone. It's like, oh gosh, sure, it's sunny and nice outside today, isn't it? Man, can you believe it snowed in the middle of April? Like, it's just a thing that we all do, right? It's something that we all have in common. It's a safe space because you don't have to worry about someone's beliefs or ideas or political views, because, you know, we all talk about the weather. I'm currently based in South Florida, and for those of you that were following this, I mean, the flooding that happened a little over a week ago before Lauderdale was astounding and effectively caught everyone by surprise. I had to shift a flight because my flight out of Fort Lauderdale was canceled. And then when I was flying back in, there were lots of delays because the airport still wasn't fully up and running. And everyone in the waiting area thinking, people on the jet bridge, people on the plane, like, that was all they could talk about. And we know, I mean, I think you all understand, you're in this room, like, we know that climate change is impacting the weather. And so it is this, I think, perfect door into the conversation, even for the people who are a little unsure, a little skeptical, or even for the people who are dismissive. Because when you dig into some of the research that Yale and George Mason do, they're a fantastic resource for any other journalist in the room. I believe it's called Climate Change in the American Mind. It's a partnership between Yale and George Mason. They have fantastic resources there. When you dig into it, even some of the people who are dismissive and say, climate change isn't real, you're blowing this out of proportion, like, enough with that already. Even those people want to hear more. They want to understand more. So just because you get a couple of crazy tweets, or your assignment desk gets, you know, someone calling angry that Nelly's talking about climate change, ignore those people, because they are truly, I think 10% personally is even an exaggerated number. It is a fraction of the total population. And even some of those angry tweeters, even some of the worst offenders for that side of the spectrum, still have a curiosity, even if they don't want to admit it. And I think that was, to your other question about how I felt about it at first. Very quick backstory is I shifted to covering climate change in full-time in 2020. That was part of what prompted me to go back and get my master's degree, which I will finish, not soon enough, but in just by the end of the summer, I will have my master's in meteorology so that I have, you know, more of the scientific basis and understanding here to talk about it more confidently. But as I started doing it, Climate Central was a fantastic resource for me. Not a commercial for them, it just really is a great resource. But even when I'm using that, I'm still thinking, okay, but I'm not a meteorologist. And I'm sure a lot of you in this room aren't meteorologists either, but you can cover this and you talk about this. And so it might be a little scarier, like, I'm out over my skis here. I don't know what I'm talking about. But these tools, and there are other resources out there, this is just a great one. These tools help you have a little bit more confidence. And the other thing I find is that, like, the flood happens in Fort Lauderdale. That day, the day after, and even the week after, we don't have an attribution study looking at that and saying, yes, this was amplified by climate change. But I think anyone who understands the science can tell you, yeah, it was. And so the place that I've found that works for me in being able to talk about this in real time before we have the actual attribution study is to talk about, what do we know that's happening? Well, we know that for every degree Fahrenheit of warming, the atmosphere is going to hold 4% more moisture. And if that 4% more doesn't sound like a lot, but if that 4% more all comes down at once, you get the things that happen in Fort Lauderdale. Oh, and then by the way, you know, if you've also been doing your homework and are familiar with, you know, your local market or the area you're covering, you know, well, as the sea level rises, it's also pushing up the water table from underneath. So when all that rain does come down, it has less space to drain. So that's also amplifying what's happening from above. So even if you don't have a specific attribution study, there are lots of things you can talk about in real time to say, we don't know about this specific storm yet, but we do know how climate change is influencing storms like this, hurricanes like this. We know how climate change is shifting the conditions for tornadoes. We know how it's impacting the weather, which makes wildfires more likely and burn bigger and burn longer. So even if it feels like you're in this sort of precarious position, you're actually not. The science is behind you, and the viewers, your readers, your audience, they really want to know about this.
I don't know if you want to set it up, have an example.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'll just let you watch it, but this is an example of how I was able to use Climate Central research in talking about a specific event and a specific wildfire action in California from, I believe this was August 2021, I believe. Another American town has been basically wiped off the map by a wildfire. There is hardly anything left in the town of Grizzly Flats. And new research shows that climate change is making these wildfires burn bigger, burn faster, and become even more destructive. Thing is, if we don't take some real action soon, this is only going to get worse by 2060. Climate alarms. The Caldor Fire, yet another mega wildfire in the West. But for this scientist at Climate Central, this one's personal.
I grew up in El Dorado County. I didn't think my hometown would be burning. You know, in right now, I thought maybe 5 years from now, maybe 10, but happening right now, it's really a shock, and I think we need to stop thinking about if and really start thinking about when.
Caitlin Weber just finished analyzing half a century of weather data for Climate Central and found that fire weather days are skyrocketing because of climate change. Basically, days which are hot, dry, and windy. That means in the last 50 years, wildfire season is now 3 times as long as it once was in California's Central Valley, South Texas, parts of Oregon, Washington. And it's twice as long in some of the places where millions of Americans live. Southern California, around Dallas-Fort Worth, Phoenix, even the entire state of Colorado. Then consider how difficult that becomes when people try to contain massive fires like Dixie and Caldor.
The weather has outstripped and Mother Nature has taken over and taken fires like the Dixie to places that I never thought was possible.
And so it's not that climate change is the cause of all these fires. Fires are, you know, a natural part of our climate system. But what's not natural is really the severity of these fires.
And while some folks will blame poor forest management, climate scientists will point to a bigger concern, drought. I mean, look at the historically barren Colorado River at Lake Mead. That is directly connected to this. Drought's bad for a few reasons. One, it might kill plants and trees, which would otherwise live. And then once they're dead and on the ground, drought just dries out the branches and leaves more quickly. I mean, this is fuel for these wildfires. And then you can also hear the helicopters overhead. These helicopters are going to nearby lakes and reservoirs and scooping up water to dump on the fire.
the worse the drought gets, the less water they have to fight these fires.
And the less confidence people have that they'll even have a home to return to. Many evacuated and have been camping out since in the parking lot of Walmart.
Well, we've thought about moving before this happened, when we were actively looking for properties elsewhere with all this devastation. I'm sure I know a lot of people are going to be thinking that they're going to say we're going to stay.
A lot of people are having a really difficult conversation right now. Really, if we choose to do nothing, it's going to keep getting worse. And it is not something that I feel a little bit about. I'm very confident that these conditions are going to continue to increase.
What a great piece.
Say, Stan, that was, you really do, terrible comment, never let a good catastrophe go to waste, but you really do use the thing that is top of mind that's just happened, and just seem to be some very intentional ways that you're connecting the dots so people see the climate groups.
The unfortunate thing is that, because I work with Climate Central, so I knew, okay, they're going to be ready to publish this research on X day. And then climate change basically did the rest of it for me. Like, I didn't have to wonder, well, when am I going to have a wildfire cover to be able to link this data? I knew we were going to have them. You know, the Dixie fire was burning, then the Caldor fire breaks out, and I'm like, okay, well, here it is. And then, you know, while I'm there, at any given time in the West, there's like peak wildfire season, hundreds of fires burning. So it's not like I had to wait for an opportunity, unfortunately. And then you go to it, you know, for anyone who's done this and covered wildfires in the West, if you've have that difficult assignment, you know, you go and you see not just a house or two or a street or two, but an entire town gone. You know, and the things that always get me are like, you see children's toys and bikes scorched, and it just is like, we've got to do something about this. And it's the thing that, for me at least, makes the difficult days and the challenging days, it helps you keep going.
It's compelling. And so I guess all of you, since either now or in the near future or in the near past, you've been in that role of being the communicator. What do you see as the barriers to making those connections more directly? And also what has worked? And I'm thinking not only of, you know, the audience barriers, but I would have assumed folks in Dallas would not be receptive, right? But I'm also wondering internally, like on the newsroom side, newsroom leadership, what barriers have you encountered? And for those in the room who might face similar challenges, to connecting the dots, any lessons or advice for any of you?
Well, I've also used a lot of your stuff, and I'm thankful for it. You know, what I've found is not so much that it's been hard to connect an event with the science. For me, the toughest part is, now what? What do we do, right? That's because I don't know. Specifically, for example, in Dallas, when we have a 17 tornado breakout, and I showed them the difference in year by year and the size of the tornadoes that are getting larger and impacting more people, I can make those connections because there are a lot of resources. For me, the difficulty is what I get from my audience. I'm like, okay, what do you want us to do, right? And then I don't have the answer for that. So that's where I need to get better and try to get more information. But connecting the dots has been, you know, easier with all the research that's been handed to us, basically, right? So that helps a lot. But now the transition, because people are open to it and they want to know, what can I do about it? For me, that's the difficult part. What can we do every day, or what can my viewers do to try to help? So,
I mean, I'll just say, I'm actually working on a story about that very thing, and we actually decided to publish like a little sort of like sneak preview answering just that specific question, because it's by far the question I get the most is like, okay, what can I do about it? And there is certainly the answer of like, you know, find whatever way you can to reduce your carbon footprint. Great. But we know this is a systemic problem. This is a system problem that's going to take collective action, not like one person buying an electric vehicle. And so I actually interviewed Anthony Lizaritz, who runs the Yale program on climate change communication, also got to talk to Catherine Cahoe, who, you know, well-known climate scientist, and their answers were very much in alignment. And it's one really important thing we can all do that we're none of us, I think, are doing enough is talk about it. Because there is that perception gap of how many people are worried and how many people are doing something about it. And the gap is largely because we're afraid. We think, oh, well, this person's they might be a climate denier, or oh, they're going to react to me. They're probably not. And so the more we can talk about it and help other people feel, oh, a lot of people actually agree with me, that does have an impact on the choices that you make when you buy a product or use a service. It will hopefully have an impact on Congress, because all of a sudden they're going to start to realize, wait, my constituents actually care about this? I was just interviewing this morning a Republican in Congress who's part of the Conservative Climate Caucus, and she says, you know, for me, I'm a Republican in a Republican district that was won by Donald Trump, and a majority of my voters understand that climate change is happening and want to do something about it. So talk about it. Like, don't forget the power of using your voice.
Also, I was going to mention, when you asked me about our producers in the newsroom, we did Univision did some research about a year ago, and it also came out that people were hungry for information about climate change. And so with this kind of information that I got, these research, the 500-person questionnaire and everything, at the end of the day, they want ratings. And so if they believe, my producers and my news directors, that me doing climbing stuff will bring ratings, they will let me do it. If this would have come back and like 4% said climate, they would be like, no, we're not doing it, right? So unfortunately, what motivates them is ratings, because it equals money and it's a company. And so that's helped me a lot, because now they want me to do it. They're like, oh, it's going to get us more viewers. It's, you know, going to help our ratings, and then do it. So.
And politicians want votes, right?
Just in moving the climate conversation forward, I think it's really important too to integrate solutions. Like, tell people what we can do, what is happening in their community. You know, the groups that are coming together and organizing to implement solutions, and also to extricate doomism. Doomism doesn't do well, right? And it, you know, yields climate anxiety. So in telling the message, and a lot of it is doomy, like your video, you know. But you know, talking about solutions gives some kind of optimism to the story that, you know, we're moving forward and we're trying to move forward, and there are a lot of solutions out there. You know, wind and solar energy is amongst the cheapest form of electricity now. And so talking about those things as part of the story, and, you know, talking about things like the built environment, the choices we make, you know, where we choose to build, our land use choices, climate equity concerns, those all exacerbate weather and climate disasters. So they're all part of the picture as well, and talking about those in that conversation, I think, is really integral as well.
You gave me a couple of examples. I don't know whether it's worth showing one of those in action. Is that what you think? We are good on time. I'm going to hit play for one. And this is, I don't know if you want to set it up, or I'll just go ahead. This is a local meteorologist incorporating. So, one more.
And welcome back on this Thursday. I want to show you a quick look at the pollen report. The trees continuing to run high. Grasses and bulb spores are low, and the leaves are out. So I have my sunroof open, and I noticed this morning driving into work, didn't have some green, like on my gear shifter. I need to wipe off from the bulbs falling out. Yeah. Today's high temperatures are made 1.5 times more likely because of our warming planet, and areas by the bay seeing an even greater influence from our changing climate and the high temperatures today. The warmth that's in areas like Annapolis and Cambridge, anywhere from 2 to 3, even 4 times more likely because of our warming world. We're at 76 degrees right now, low humidity, winds pretty light too. We had nice breezy winds.
So, you know, the thing that jumps out, and I lived in a while for D.C., right? And so this year, with the cherry blossom, I'm in D.C. about 3 weeks early. I may or may not have a community garden, you know. You're like, you got to plant your tomatoes 2 weeks sooner than you used to, right? The allergies, These are gateway opportunities to communicate climate concepts to audiences that might otherwise not be as easy to reach, right? And so I love these examples of finding the everyday ways in which climate shows up in people's lives and the community. So just love to hear any other examples of where you see the opportunity to make that connection that really is effective.
Well, unfortunately, I used to have downtime in Dallas, right? It used to be December, I wouldn't get tornadoes. Or the summer, gets too hot even for thunderstorms, right? But now there's no break. We had five or six tornadoes in 1 week in December, this December. So unfortunately, I don't have to look for opportunities. We have freezes that are, going down to 9 degrees. It was 9 degrees in Dallas. So those are the extremes. But for example, the months that are the quiet ones in Dallas, the heat has become so extreme that people are dying. People leave a baby in the car for more than 30 minutes. Wildlife is just falling out of trees. The birds, we went through a period of extreme heat that we would just find birds all over the place. It's just the saddest thing. So for me, it used to be where I had quiet months. There are no quiet months anymore. So there's always an opportunity to talk about it. And for example, the animal thing, animal lovers, those are the willpower of animal lovers. You don't want to mess with a cat person or with a dog person. And during the summers, with animals dying of heat, also livestock, right? In a lot of the farms. So anyway, people are just open to it, and there's an opportunity each and every day because we have pollen, right? When it's not pollen, we have extreme wind. If not, we have tornadoes. If not, we have large hail. So in my market, at least, there is no downtime anymore, and there's always an opportunity to talk about climate change and the way it's impacting us.
I want to be sure we have time for questions. Jason, we saw your story, and you really made multiple direct connections to climate. What reaction have you been getting from your audience when they see that kind of reporting?
I mean, I would say, our audience loves it and is hungry for it. The negative reactions I get are on social media, and I learned to tune that out. It's not helpful. I mean, I will reference this again. I was interviewing a Republican member of Congress this morning, and she said, if we could turn off Twitter for a month, you would be amazed at the bipartisanship that would happen in Washington. So I think that's a message. I think
it's working on that.
Yeah, we're close. Let's check in again tomorrow.
So maybe we'll get up our shuffle. No, I think the thing that I would encourage, especially to fellow journalists in the room, is don't feel like you're going out on a limb. Don't feel like that one angry email or a couple of negative responses on social media is indicative of your audience, because it's not. So that's the big thing I would say. People are hungry for this. Again, even Fox News viewers have curiosity about this. I've been watching Fox Weather a bit lately out of curiosity, and I noticed it's not as blatant, but it comes up, and they'll sort of work it in. And I think that says that they understand that their audience knows. Everyone knows the weather just isn't what it used to be, right? You don't need a degree to understand that.
No, that's a great point. We referenced it a couple times, so linked at the QR code is the Yale George Mason Collaborative Research. One piece of that, to your point, is below an age, I don't want to say it's 29, party doesn't matter. Climate matters to all people under 30, and that is not a party-based divide at that point, so to your point. So, the audience is there. It's so interesting to hear from each of you that when you make that connection, actually your audience appreciates it. And I mean, I suppose it's good news in that it's an opportunity. It's bad news because it is the world we're living in, that today we have those opportunities to make the connection between everyday weather and climate, unfortunately, everyday. But I want to be sure we have time for questions, so we'd love to take some. I will just do my part as moderator and say, first preference to SEJ members, please state your name, and let's try to keep to questions versus comments, but I saw a hand, then a hand, then a hand.
Hi, I'm really excited to ask a question, and just excited to hear from all you guys. They're inspiring. So in November, I started as the Good Morning Idaho weather anchor, and my background's in environmental journalism, so I don't have a lot of meteorology experience, and it's really hard. My question's about tone. Like, I think it's really hard to be like, hi, happy Wednesday. I hope everyone has a wonderful day. By the way, we're going to hit the 60s tomorrow and Saturday. Yeah, and I struggle a lot because I work on a happy morning show, and how am I supposed to talk about something depressing that, you know, I know, Chase, you're doing some reporting on what to do about it, but it's not easy to work that into your show, so, sorry.
I think that's something that every young meteorologist kind of wrestles with. I just had a new meteorologist start in the morning. She's actually a weather anchor. She's studying to be a meteorologist. And we had severe weather and tornado warnings. And she's like smiling the whole time. I said, so we have a tornado on the ground? I thought, you know. But she's just very cheery, right, and very happy. And so I have to work with her on, okay, there's a time to be sweet and nice and everything. It doesn't have to be mean, but your audience really respects when you're being serious, right? So you have to be able to kind of turn that. And it's not being mean, it's just being serious. Like, this is not what I'm telling you. I can be cute, I can be fun, I can be, but now I'm telling you there's a tornado on the ground, so you need to listen to me. And so when you're talking about something serious, don't be afraid to be serious to you. And they know that you can transition and be fun you, right? But to build that trust that everybody talks about, they have to know that you're serious about severe weather, that you're serious about climate change, but that you're also cheery in the morning and you know, can bring a happy smile to them when it's nice weather, right? So it's, you have to kind of practice it. But it goes on forever, because now, you know, that time that we had the tornado going through, we started getting images of cars being thrown everywhere. I thought it was people dying, and it was actually one of the tornadoes hit a dealership. But I had to stop myself from crying on the air, right? Like, it was like, and so you have to monitor how you come across all the time, even in severe situations like that.
Yeah, I was just saying, yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of acting that is involved in a way. As far as tone is, and I think news viewers are used to anchors, reporters, meteorologists making that tonal shift in a brief amount of time. So they're used to, you know, someone going from like, you know, this is a little bit lighter to this is heavier. But also too, you know, if you want to start out with some of the lighter topics, like with allergies and with everyday things that aren't, you know, so hugely impactful and threatening to human health and safety, but just putting that little nugget of climate change, you know, is amplifying this in your audience's mind, might be a good way to get in and kind of like build your confidence in talking about it more often, and then you can tackle some of those heavier topics like, you know, the tornado impacts or hurricanes or extreme heat.
That's good.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, I have a hand here, and then I think we maybe follow the mic rather than
the mic. I am Clint Wilder, Clean Energy Reporter with Clean Edge. So used to hear the term global warming, and has climate change sufficiently supplanted that in your viewers' consciousness, or is this still? I bring it up because, you know, the old, gee, it's freezing cold or it's snowing, and yet they say it's global warming. Well, you know, they're wrong.
Well, I had a tweet that I didn't put in the deck that was right. That's a great question. So, I mean, I'll paraphrase and say, how do you respond at the local level when you get that, like, oh, I thought we had global warming, but it's cold this week, and I think we're getting at it. How do you help your audience better understand the difference between weather, which can happen any day of the year, and climate change and the trends?
So a couple of things. I mean, I think certain NBC stations and groups have actually pivoted to using climate in crisis as a term to even take it a step above climate change. Climate change, I think, is more common because even people who don't agree that it's human caused can agree that the climate is changing in terms of like just the branding perspective. And I'll still use global warming if there's like, you know, multiple references in a story. It's repetitive to say climate change. So I'll say global warming. I'll throw that in there. But sometimes in terms of the point about between weather and climate, and please chime in on this too, I sometimes acknowledge what I'm about to say is counterintuitive, that you think, okay, how can we have a more intense blizzard, or why are we seeing this ice storm, and how is that connected to climate change? And sometimes just acknowledging that, like, I know this doesn't make sense, but let me explain it. Like, let's talk through this. Gives people that cue, and I think also just lets them know that you get it, that you're listening. Like, I know it doesn't make sense at first that a blizzard is going to dump more snow as the planet gets warmer, but let me talk to you about why that is.
That's a great point, yes. I've gotten that question a few times in my role at Climate Central, and your answer was more complex.
No, that's
okay. I was thinking of it as, like, you know, it is global warming, right? It's global warming, like our warming stripes show you, right? It's the warming temperature, the average global temperature that is warming, that's causing climate change. So the globe is warming, and it's causing all these changes, which are, you know, erratic and can be extreme cold, can be blizzard activity, can be more snowfall, can be drought. So that's a general.
And I will, on behalf of Climate Central, say I've seen so many markets, the power of data. You pop up the 50-year trend, and it puts that question in context, which I think is what you're talking about. Yes.
It's important to organize neighborhoods, and neighborhood groups. I am a meteorologist. I'm also a climate journalist, and I talk both of these to students, particularly weather and climate. But one of the most satisfying things that I've done in my life in the last 3 years is to join and strengthen neighborhood emergency teams in Portland, Oregon. And so, for example, in the last year and a half, we have had to go on alert, and when we had a 116 Fahrenheit day in mid-June, bring people to cool centers before they died, essentially, before they suffered heat exhaustion or heat stroke. So we did that. Basically, our most important role was to find them and transport them to safe places. And we did the same thing when we had 16 inches of snow about 2 months ago. And, 10 inches of snow at 16 degrees Fahrenheit brought people to warming shelters. But I've seen the change in the San Diego Canyon multiple times. So we also, The same wildfire outbreak that caused the San Diego Canyon fires also reached the suburbs of Portland, and we, because of the intense smoke and ashes, set up a shelter in a shopping center. So organizing neighbors and neighborhoods, especially if you can get your community to do this, to find and train people. We are all trained in managing emergencies medically and shutting off utilities and so forth. But it's extreme. It's becoming more and more important because of our warming climate.
Thank you for sharing that. I was in Portland. I hit 117. And so much for Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland not being air conditioned. Yes.
Hi.
Questions, please. And please take me with you.
Hi, my name is Annie Snaps. I write about local government for the Herald Tribune in Sarasota, Florida. And the state of Florida likes to use the word resiliency a lot when referring to like any kind of climate change adaptation. I try to not use the word resiliency in my reporting for the most part. But I'm wondering if you guys have any tips for like when like governments try to use other filler words instead of talking about climate change to CLRIs, and they'll often even use it to refer to their programs, like this is a resiliency program. I'm wondering if you have any advice for working around that and kind of making sure you're actually talking about words that people both know about and that relate to science.
I would say that, well, first of all, adaptation is incredibly important. We're past the point of just being able to bring down emissions. There are certain things that are already happening and are going to continue to happen. So I think adaptation is certainly an important topic to cover, and maybe even is a gateway for people into the conversation and into climate action without feeling like they're, you know, attacking fossil fuels that they might love, right? So adaptation is important. I think it's giving people context about what resiliency means, that there's a certain level of resiliency or adaptation that's necessary right now, and there's another level that's going to be necessary in not even 10 years, but 5 years. And so I think that can also be a way for you to talk about the bigger picture of like, all right, we're going to either spend $500 million or $100 million, and that depends on how much we cut our emissions. Like, bringing it back so that people understand that, like, yes, resiliency is important, but resiliency and adaptation will be much cheaper if we talk about these other things that you may not want to talk about, like in the state of Florida, where they want to like tap dance around that. But everyone in Florida knows the climate change is happening. The sea level rise is accelerating, right?
And don't be afraid to call them out on their bull, because, for example, when the power grid went down, and then, you know, we went at the governor, and we went at, because you're not going to be resilient when 250 people are dying, freezing to death, right? I mean, and one thing, unfortunately, that this tragedy did, it brought everybody to the same level, because it wasn't just the poor areas that lost power. It was the rich, rich neighborhoods that didn't have power, and they also were freezing to death, right? So when you have emergencies like this, resilience, I would laugh if somebody, you know, said something like that. So when you know that they are just full of it, just say it. You know, we set it on, we had them on, and we drilled them. I mean, they had some very rough months. They still got reelected, I don't know. But at least we gave them hell for a while for what happened.
Yeah, I think this goes back to, in some ways, your question too, which is authenticity and communicating with the audience. What I appreciate about what I think TV minutes do so well is they have a conversation with the audience. Like, who talks that way out in real life? Like, I mean, that isn't the term we would use in a conversation with our friends. And so I think, along with avoiding greenwashing, if we're going to be effective as communicators, finding a way to talk about these concepts that's meaningful and that the audience can relate to is part of our job. Other questions? Yes, question back. Oh, sorry, man. Let's go to this side next, after. And we'll try to keep them all to questions. I want to get everyone out at 3:25.
Talking about terminology, buzzwords, there are those who say, this is established, repeat it, tell people what's been proven, and let's move past that point. And then, well, for example, I was at a science writers conference, and Sedona Chin from the University of Wisconsin, she presented data that supported the idea that people react negatively to certain buzzwords. Just, you know, if you say that word, they're going to tune you out, and that's it. So I think in my personal reporting, I try to avoid the buzzwords and make a point without saying things that are going to trigger the audience, and I wonder what your perspectives are.
What were some of the buzzwords, like global warming?
Even to say climate change, even to say global warming.
I didn't answer a little bit ago, but I stay away from global warming and say climate change, just because I know it will be used against me, and it's mostly English speakers in Texas, right? during that freeze. We're all freezing to death. Oh, what about global warming? Huh? I can use some of that global warming. So I just stay away from it. I'm not sure if it's the correct thing, but I just call it climate change because I know Texas, it will be used against you.
Or some of the methods that we try to explain ourselves to say that 99% of climate scientists agree that that kind of thing that a lot of journalists reach for. Whereas you can take another approach and just explain it your own way. Wonder what you all think.
Yeah, I think plain language is always the best because people don't want to be talked down to, right? You want to have an open conversation when, you know, you're saying things like that, and especially when you're giving a lot of facts and figures, which sometimes you do need some facts and figures, but I think plain language is the best way to describe it. And that's our job as communicators, right? Taking these more complex concepts and breaking it down for people who aren't in the field, you know, making it understandable for the everyday person, right? Everyone out there that they can consume it. So I think, you know, you as a journalist or us being meteorologists, being that intermediary is a really important role, and you have to use your best judgment. I would say with trigger words, though, I think that's probably more applicable. Like the reactants you get would maybe be more for the dismissive group, which, you know, as we've been talking about, is, you know, significantly insignificant now in the climate conversation across the country. So, you know, I would not worry too much about it. But, yeah, I think when you get too much into trigger words, you're moving away for Earth, you know, like a trigger word was like cliches. You're moving away from plain language, and I think that's probably the best way to approach it.
Yeah, one meteorologist said our warming planet instead of global warming, and right. I was like, I'm going to steal that. It's more of a, I don't know, like that's like an easier way to say the same thing.
Absolutely, that's a great point.
I'll put in a plug for it. And then at George Mason, Center for Climate Change Communication. It's linked, but he, others have said it, I can't say for sure who started, but the 10 words, if you've heard the 10 words, right? But it's bad, it's real, it's us, scientists agree, there's hope. And then repeat a lot. And then it just gets back to the like clear communication, right? And not to apologize for the things that are established. I mean, I remember distinctly, the third year of the Trump campaign, national news organizations started to write headlines that said, the president lied today when he said, dot, 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 right? It took 3 years to get to that point. So are we at that point with climate where we would just state things as facts, that are facts? So, but I think Ed Medak, he's a specialist in climate change communication. He's a great resource for anyone trying to get the tone, right?
And can, I'll just say quickly, I know we're tight on time, but listen to the way that politicians talk about it. A Democrat will say, we've got to zero out emissions, we've got to cut, you know, we've got to stop burning fossil fuel. And then a Republican, talking about the same thing, will say, clean air. Who doesn't want clean air? Everyone wants clean air. So you can talk about the same thing with different language, and I don't think you should necessarily like feel apologetic about it. It's really just about like knowing your audience, right?
I'd love to get in one question from this side.
Okay, well, actually this relates to what you were saying. So I have cover topics like extreme weather, climate change, and communities for public media, so NPR, PRI, which obviously have a very liberal audience. And, you know, I know that most media consumers, like Laura Zanelli, and, you know, it's great to hear that your audience believes in climate change, wants to hear more, but a lot of us work for organizations where our consumers already believe what we're saying. They believe that climate change is real. But how do you propose reaching the other side of the population, reaching the Fox News viewers or the people that are the deniers? Because I mean, I asked this in a panel yesterday, they didn't really know what to do about that. Like, what are the strategies? Language is one. What are other strategies for reaching the other side of the population, which is key? Like, I mean, I've spent my entire career in public media, but my audience skews liberal. So how do you reach the people that really need to take action?
I mean, I think this goes back to, I should have thought to send you this link, but the soundbite from Catherine Cahill in this story is that the biggest gap is not between people who believe climate change is real and those who don't, because that's less than 10%. So do you need less than 10% if you have 90% of the audience? I would argue that you don't. The biggest gap is between the people that believe and the people who are doing something about it. So if it's just about like clicks and eyeballs, which I work in television, I understand like ratings are important. I don't need 10% if I have 90% of the audience. So, like, why put yourself through that, like, anguish of, like, let me get the 10% most skeptical people to watch Fox News? If we got 60% of people, if we got 40% of the people doing something about it, then I think we're on the right track.
And also, I think this kind of brings it all together to talk, because, for example, Amarillo, Texas, and Abilene, Texas, these are all Republican, very red areas, right? And they are suffering because of the droughts and the extreme heat, their cattle, it hurts their pockets. So we've done a few stories about how they are also worried about difference in climate. They don't like to use climate change or this or that, but because it is impacting them now also, they are more open. So I think if you talk to the ones that you're trying to reach, because for example, you know, most of Texas is a red state, so the main cities are not. But there are things that impact them, these droughts, their cattle, all of that, that you can reach them with and have that connection with them without using trigger words, because that turns them off and scares them, right? But it is impacting everybody. And so you just have to find that one story that will affect the deniers.
I'll just link to Climate Central, because they need that information. A lot of people, they know climate, they know the extreme weather is real, but they don't believe it's due to climate change. So thank you to all of you for everything you said today.
That sounds like a rap cue to me.